Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, August 18th, 2005. This session, The Art of Raising an Ethical Child, Part 2, Five Common Mistakes, presented by Hallie Florine in the Fireside Room, disc number FLH-2005-04. Let's listen in.
In yesterday's lecture, I talked about some of the brain issues related to conscience development, that in order for a conscience to develop adequately, emotions have to be involved. And one of the ways we can key in on teaching children important truths is to take advantage of times when there may be an emotional peak to do teaching. For example, if kids are having a fight and they're all upset, that might be a good moment to stop the fight and do some talking, because the child will remember it more then, because it's emotionally tagged. And I don't want to go into all of the things that we talked about yesterday, but one thing I want to mention. Oh, by the way, my name is Hallie Florine, and I'm a licensed marriage and family therapist. I've been working in this field for 35 years, although I'm not right now, because I am long-term staff at Holden, and I do contributions here. But I really enjoy the opportunity that I've had several times this summer of presenting a portion of the workshop that I did for a year and a half around the country. And that was called Overindulged Children. And so I'm using portions of that workshop, and it's really fun for me to have this opportunity. Now, one thing I want to mention is we're going to talk about some common mistakes parents make. And I don't want you to take anything personally, especially since I've made a lot of them. So I'm not standing here as the shining example, saying this is what I did and you should do too. These are just some ideas, and you may disagree with some of them, and that's fine. But don't take it as a judgment on your own parenting, because the fact that you're here probably makes it probable that you're a pretty good parent. Those of you that are parents, how many are grandparents? Yeah. And sometimes that's really hard. I've had grandparents come to my workshop that are so frustrated with the way their children are raising their kids. And so if you want to bring any of those issues up, that would be fine. Now, I shared a lot of information yesterday, and we didn't have much discussion. I want it to be more informal today, so feel free to jump in with comments or questions, and don't worry about interrupting me, okay? So today we're going to be talking about seven issues of moral development, and these are seven things that are common problems that parents have, and with some ideas about how to address those problems. So I'm going to hit the door so we're not disturbed. And the seven that we're going to talk about is too little parenting time, lack of a clear belief system and values, lack of structure and consequences, too much help. And what I mean by that is parents giving their kids too much help. The same goes for too much stuff, parents that give their kids too much stuff. And just a comment about that, there was a research study where they put kids in a room just chock full of toys, and then compared it with putting kids in a room that might have two or three toys. And they found the kids in the room with two or three toys more actively played with those toys than the kids that just had a zillion things around. And I think that's true for a lot of kids, that they have way too much stuff. And then focus on constant happiness, always keeping kids happy, and too much focus on self-esteem. Now, I'm going to talk more about that because I'm not at all against self-esteem. I think it's wonderful when kids have good self-esteem. But I think the mistake is often how kids get self-esteem and feeling that the way to give kids self-esteem is just compliment them for everything they do. And that isn't really a good way to do it. So let's start with issue one. You know, we talked yesterday about parents speaking to their kids on the average 8 to 13 minutes a day. And we're all too busy. You know, not necessarily at Holden, but in the real world, you know, people are torn many, many different directions. And I was a single mom, and I had to work full time. And so I took great comfort in this. Oh, I need another quotation marks. Anyway, I took a great comfort in this saying, it's not the quantity of time you spend with your kids, it's the quality of time. And actually, what we know now is you need both. Yeah. You know, you 10 minutes of quality time is not enough. And William Doherty, this is a quote from The Intentional Family, families are overscheduled outside the home and underscheduled within the home. I really like that because nowadays kids are carted to activities all the time. You know, now they have soccer practice, then they have junior choir, and then they have music lessons, and then, you know, And kids are running a dozen different ways. And parents are feeling that they're really being good parents by doing that. And yet, I think the place to start is scheduling time for the family and making that the first thing you schedule. That perhaps you have a family night once a week, and that's sacred. Nobody misses family night. That becomes the priority, as opposed to how many different sports a kid can get involved in or how many musical instruments they can learn to play. And so I just want to go through some ideas about taking back family time. And I don't know if any of you have done this. I sometimes joke that I'm downwardly mobile, my salary has gone down over the past 20 years. And I've met, in my travels, I've met lots of families that have said, we don't need a house this big. We don't need this many cars. We don't need to always buy clothes brand new at the most expensive department store. We can scale down. And then the parents aren't as at so much pressure at work. You know, they may get jobs that pay less and are less stressful. Or one parent could work part-time or work in the home. And so lowering a standard of living is probably one of the most powerful ways of gaining more time. I had a participant tell me that her kids were grown, but she told me about a couple of years, actually 3 years, that they decided to do something different. They had high-powered jobs and a lovely large home, and they decided to become caretakers on this estate where they lived in a little apartment. And the kids had the estate to run around on, and the job was not very demanding. But they really had to watch their pennies because they made very little. But when the kids reminisce about their happiest time in their childhood, they always hearken back to that time where they had very little money, but they had lots of time as a family. And you know, I look at some of the long-term staff families here, as this is kind of a special time for them where they can do lots of activities as a family. Another thing to do is for parents to have more coverage, you know, where mom might go to work early or in the day. Dad goes later, so he's able to see the kids off to school and so forth, and then mom's there when the kids come home from school. Unfortunately, when that happens, mom and dad see each other less, which is not a good thing, but that's something that families have done. Another thing is to reduce kids' activities. You know, my own feeling is kids can only really invest in about two activities. And so, you know, if they have a sport and they have a club or something, that's pretty much enough for them. Mm-hmm. They don't need to have six or seven different things going. And so it might be good to have kids make decisions mm-hmm. about what is it they want to focus on. And I'm not saying that they can't switch activities, especially when kids are younger. It's perfectly fine to try out different activities, but they don't need to try them out all at once. Yeah.
I think that's very important for their later life. Because most, speaking for myself, I tried to do way too much when I was a parent too. It's not only the kids who are trying to do too much, but it's the parents who are trying to do too much too.
Yeah, and also as kids get older, if they're more invested in just a couple of activities, they learn the skill of perseverance. You know, that if they, for example, choose piano as one of their two activities, and they stick with it, they will have gained the experience of sticking with something a long time and realize how important that is for success. You know, there's a lot of kids growing up today that they've tried everything, but they really have skills in nothing. Have you seen that? And I think I'm not saying this was the right thing to do, but when my son got towards junior high age, I told him, I want you to pick an activity that you're going to concentrate on till you graduate from high school. And by doing that, I think he learned that if you stick with something, you can gain much better skills, which is so important when people have high goals, that perseverance. You know, one of the easiest ways to get more time with kids is to use drive time. You know, have a practice that nobody sticks earphones in, nobody puts the radio up loud, that car time is talk time. And I think this is especially good with teenagers because they're trapped. You know, and also they don't need to look at you. Mm-hmm. And that's really key with teenagers, that they'll talk more to their parents when they don't have to look at them than if you sit down face to face. One reminiscence I have is when my son and I were starting out on a car trip. And I hadn't realized we'd been talking a lot in the car, but he said, Mom, let's have a wide-ranging conversation. And it tickled me so much. But I realized that he enjoyed that kind of free flow where we could talk about just whatever we wanted, that was something he really treasured. And I grew up with family night. How many grew up with family night? You did? Sort of?
Yeah, we always had, Saturday nights were family night pretty much. But it wasn't necessarily sacred, but often that was
what. Yeah. One teacher that came to a workshop told me that they always had pizza on Saturday night. And that was always family time. But when they got to be, the kids got to be teenagers, the parents realized that was a lot to ask the kids to always have Saturday night at home. I think it was Friday night. So once a month they would have, you can invite your friends to come. And their name was Powell. So it was pizza at the Powells that got to be kind of famous in the community of a sort of a tradition that they had. But I think that having family night as a special time when the family has fun together, whether it's going for a picnic or it's, you know, having popcorn in a movie, you know, just having time that's sacred as a family. And another thing that's great to do is to have one-on-one dates. In one family, they had three kids. And so what would happen is the parents would rotate on a Saturday afternoon. One parent would have one child, the other parent would have the other child, and the third child would go to a neighbor's house. And then they'd rotate. And so 2 out of 3 weeks, they would have alone time with one of their parents. And it was alone time that was where they had the ability to talk, like to go out for lunch or to go to the zoo or something like that. And this I highly recommend is putting all of those media things in the family room. And first of all, a parent can supervise better. You know, I think it's really a mistake to have kids have computers and televisions in their own room or video games, because then they can isolate themselves and you can't monitor very effectively. But if you have everything in the family room, then kids can, you know, enjoy their games or enjoy the computer, but the parents could keep an eye on what they're doing. Of course, limiting television, I think, is an important and other media. And one of the most powerful things you can do is make dinner mandatory. One research study showed that only a quarter of families have routinely a meal that they eat together. And then a research project was done where they were looking at a lot of different factors, you know, doing a good job on your homework, getting special tutoring or other things. And they found that the most powerful thing for young adult success was, they looked at these people in their 20s, early 20s, and they looked at, you know, how good their relationships were, how good a job they had, how well they were managing their finances. And they found the most powerful thing was the family having dinner together. Yeah.
Oh, a number of years ago, I taught kindergarten, and I was discovering that the real difficult time during my morning or afternoon was snack time and sharing time. And as I got to know the children's stories, I found out that their usual mode of eating was sitting in front of a TV.
Right.
They didn't know what it was to sit down together around a table, and they didn't know how to listen, to be quiet and listen to another person when they were talking.
Yeah, they don't have any experience with it.
And just recently in the New York Times there was an article saying that, again, emphasizing the importance of family mealtime for children's success. It didn't carry it on to the older, but interesting, the same results.
Yeah, and for families that haven't done it and want to start it, it can be uncomfortable at first. So sometimes you can have it a little bit structured, like going around the table and each person saying the best thing that happened to them today. And maybe going around and said, this is what I was worried about today. You know, so that you get the conversational ball rolling.
So, can I just,
Yeah.
What are the things in our house? My dad worked a lot of hours when I was growing up, and he often had meetings at 7 a.m. for breakfast, and he wasn't home until 8 p.m. But we always had breakfast together, and it didn't matter if it was the summer and Dad had to leave at 7 or 6:45. We had breakfast then at 6:15 or whenever it was, and I remember comatose breakfast for me sitting there. But that was, you know, looking back on it, I think it really mattered, and it was really, we often had dinner together as well, but there was just no questions asked. It was time to get up and have breakfast and sit down around the table. It wasn't just, you know, everyone grab a bowl of cereal. There was
My brother-in-law, who's a physician, I used to work long into the evening, and then when his kids were kind of getting into 11 and 12, he realized he was missing a lot of their growing up. So he made it a habit that he would break his routine. He might go to work after dinner, but he always came home for dinner. And I just, you know, so often, of course, I wasn't guilty of any of these. You know, if my son were here, he'd be laughing, because I can get into lecture mode so easily, you know, where I want to impart all of my tremendous wisdom to him, and I just can't understand why he isn't eating it up, you know. And I think for a lot of parents, particularly with teenagers, they get into that, you know, the interrogation mode. I try to get my kids to talk about their feelings, and they just won't do it. Well, the kid feels grilled, you know. They're not going to open up to that. The lecture mode, and inattention, where you're just half listening. I think really listening takes effort. And one thing I like to stress with listening to kids is to not only listen to the words, but also listen to the music. But what I mean by that is their chin trembling. Is their speech pressured? Are there tears in their eyes? You know, that often just by listening to the tone of what they're saying or their nonverbal behaviors, you can really begin to understand what's important to them. So you can't do that, you know, while you're putting away the groceries very effectively. Any other comments about building time for kids?
Well, I think besides the verbal stuff that takes place, they need to see your smile. They need to hear those kinds of affirmations that are nonverbal. You mentioned the nonverbal a bit, but I think specifically to be able to see their mom or dad smile kind of says the world's not bad everywhere.
Right, and it also, you know, that parents don't need to gush, but just nodding with a smile can be very powerful. Okay, you know, you know, if I had my way, which I seldom do, people would have to get licensed before they could have kids. You know, you need a fishing license. Why shouldn't you need a parenting license? Of course, that's not going to happen, at least not currently. But I think it, second best would be for there to be pre-parenting classes. Now, there's often pre-parenting classes, but they often stress, you know, diet and, you know, basic care things. But I think a pre-parenting class where there was discussion of how would you like your kids to be as adults? What are the kind of principles you'd like them to live by? What are the things that you think are most important for a child to learn? And really think that through. What, as an adult, are my most important beliefs? And, you know, sit down and think about that before you have kids, because, of course, after you have a kid, you're not going to have time for the next 3 years to think about it, really. So I think that's a great way to start. And then, of course, modeling behavior that is important. And talking about it. For example, mom makes some soup and takes it next door to the neighbor who is ill. And then as they're coming and brings the child along with her, and then as they're walking back saying, I feel so good about helping Mary. And how do you feel about it? And the kid's saying, I like that. That is a wonderful teaching experience, that doing things for others can feel good. A lot of kids don't learn that. That's not taught to them. And of course, church is a wonderful training ground, you know, where you can discuss. We go to church every Sunday. You go to Sunday school. We do these things for these reasons. This is what's most important to this family. In fact, you know, I think it's great to have a family mission statement. And first the parents talking it over, and then maybe having a family meeting and say, you know, what is going to be our identity as a family? How do we want other people to know us? Yeah.
Can I back up to the belief system?
Yeah.
We have a grandson who has many difficulties, probably Asperger's.
Yeah.
And so consequently, behavior is not predictable and doesn't like church. So he was having a particularly difficult time on a Sunday morning. So I said, well, Ben, I'll stay home with you. And then he said, no, I know church is important to you. And we went and had one of the best days in church with Ben.
Yeah, because it was his choice.
He's picking it up. It's important.
Yeah.
Not by the lecture system.
Right. He's picking the behavior up. But even, too, is talking about when you have difficulty at church, what are some things that you can do? You know, do you need a timeout? And can you whisper that to me? I need a timeout. And leave so that the child has some tools to turn to. Now, I'm going to be giving some examples of mistakes parents make. And a really common one is what I call vicarious parenting. This happens a lot when people have had an unhappy childhood. You know, maybe they had an abusive parent, or maybe they had a neglectful parent. So they say to themselves, when I have children, I'm going to do it differently. I'm going to make sure my child has a happy childhood rather than the kind of childhood I had. Now, what's wrong with that? Doesn't it seem like that would be fine?
Except they don't know what a happy childhood is.
Pardon?
I mean, except that they haven't experienced a happy childhood.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
I mean, how?
Yeah. And also, they may protect kids from learning experiences mm-hmm. so that it becomes lopsided. They make one thing too important. And what I will share with families is that, you know, if you have a lot of anger left over from your childhood, it's better to work that out with your pastor or with your counselor than working it out through your child. You know, it's when you've got it personally worked out that you can be the best parent.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
You probably are familiar with the book Without Spanking or Spoiling, but that one was a great tool in a couple ways, and you've hit on some of them already. They have a list in there of what are your values and beliefs in the if there are two parents or in, you know, who's ever involved in the child rearing. Can answer that. And what's interesting is, although my husband's a pastor and I'm a loyal churchgoer and we seem to have many of the same values, we differ on some important things. And that was really important for us to work out. And I think another thing that they talk about in that book is not raising your child according to what you expected of yourself? Are you, you know, are there things that you wish you could be that you want your child to be now, but you know, you never were in the first place? And
yeah, you know, that happened in a small way with me. You know, my mother never had the opportunity to learn to play the piano. So my sister and I had piano lessons throughout our growing up, whether we liked it or not. Now, I don't regret any of that, you know, and I love the piano, but you know, that's kind of saying, this is my need, and that's going to be paramount. I like that list idea, because then if you differ on beliefs, you can take some time as a couple and talk it through and say, well, you know, we differ, but how will we present it to our child? Because I think it's fine for parents to differ as long as they've talked about how they'll present that to their child. Okay, this is going to be probably our longest section. Because I think structure is so important in child rearing. And so I'm going to go through many mistakes. One is permissiveness. And I came from, you know, I was a young adult during the 70s. And, you know, those of us that come from that era, you know, we believed that children were like these beautiful little flowers, buds. And if you just let them be, they'll blossom into lovely roses. Had anybody here had that same kind of impression? Maybe not. But you know, anybody that's read Lord of the Flies knows that children left to their own devices don't turn into angels. And there's a book called How to Be a Mensch, you know, the Yiddish term for kind of a good person. And it starts out by saying, children are born savages. our job is to make them into human beings. I really like that. And so I see permissiveness as a real mistake. And I'm gonna look at some variants of permissiveness. One is giving away parental power. Have any of you known families where the kids are the boss? They dictate to the parents? Does it drive you crazy? You know, it just drives me crazy. Honey, would it be all right if we get a babysitter tonight so we can go out to dinner? You know, giving away that power, having the kids run the show, is really dysfunctional, because the kids, as we talked about the prefrontal cortex not being fully developed, kids don't have the skills to be in charge. And so they really shouldn't be in charge. Now, that's not to say you shouldn't give kids experience at making decisions. You know, I think you can start very early giving kids experience. You know, an example would be, you know, a three-year-old. You know, we're going to have lunch in a few minutes. Now, if you want to, pick up your toys now, and then after lunch you can watch that new video we bought. Or if you want to keep playing, that's fine too. But then after lunch we won't have time for the video. You choose. And the parent wins whichever way it happens. But what the child may learn, the child may think, I don't want to quit playing. And then after lunch is so disappointed that she can't watch the video, then the child has learned an important lesson about delaying gratification. So I think one key in giving kids decision-making experience is to always give them a limited number of choices, and that all of the choices should be the parents should be able to live with. You know, I think at most three choices. I think three is good, because that gives the child the impression that they have more of an expansive list of choices, but never give them a choice that you can't live with. And another thing that happens is that parents will feel that it's good experience for kids to negotiate decisions. And I agree with that. Once kids have a lot of experience with making good choices through limited decision, limited decision making, then they may get to an age where you can say, well, what do you think is the appropriate consequence for this? And the kids will come up with a better consequence than you will. But it's only because they've had the background of experience. And so negotiation, kids need to build skills in negotiation rather than manipulation. Because for many parents, they teach the kids that if they're just persistent enough, the parent will cave. And then they've learned the skill of manipulation as opposed to negotiation. Any comments about that? Or? Probably preaching to the choir.
Well, I guess one of the things I think is that here is it's so clear, you know, I definitely agree with that, but it's so much muddier than that in real life. Because you start giving choices and pretty soon you're negotiating. There are some things that you realize, well, I could really, that they have a good point, and sure, I can negotiate on that. And then pretty soon you're negotiating everything. And you're just like, wait a minute.
Yeah.
And so it's really, it's if it was so clear all the time, it would be so much easier.
Yeah, it would be, wouldn't it? Yeah. Oh, for a black and white world. I always remember what a psychiatrist told me that was supervising me when I was first starting doing psychotherapy. And I was so worried about missing, you know, doing something wrong or missing the point or something. And he said, if it's important, it'll happen again. You know, that you don't just get one chance, you get multiple chances.
Yeah. Well, I was just going to say that we had, our fourth child was born 7.5 years after our last child. We already had two teenagers, right? So he grew up watching, I mean, for teenagers it was appropriate to negotiate and discuss and everything. And he grew up learning that, so I mean, and so we always were in the mode of negotiating with him. Because we were doing it with our other kids, and he was learning that, and it wasn't good for him.
No, it wasn't. That's right. Limited choices would be better.
That's a good point.
At what age or developmental period do you see this change happening? I know it's certainly a broad area, but
the thing is, the earlier you start, the younger they will be able to do it, and kids differ. I hate the age thing.
Right, I know.
You know, because kids are so different.
Right.
But if you're starting, very early with a kid, you know, maybe by 9 or 10 they can have a limited amount of negotiation, and that by 13 or 14, they really are skilled at making good decisions. But some kids at 16 are not any good at making decisions. You know, that figure whatever they can get away with is what's the right thing to do. So there's such a disparity. Protecting from consequences, you know, that's one of the toughest things. But in traveling the country, I heard so many horror stories from school personnel about what parents would do to protect their kids from consequences. Some of you may remember this story that hit the media where a teacher, and I think it was either junior high or middle school or high school, I think it was probably high school, but this teacher told her class that they had a term paper for the class that would be the majority of their grade. And so if they got a poor grade on the term paper, chances are they'd get a poor grade for the grading period. And and she said, if I catch any kids cheating, or rather plagiarizing, that will be an automatic failing grade. And so she used a website some of you may be familiar with. It's called turnitin.com, which is a website that checks for plagiarism. And the kind of cool thing about the website is that every paper that's submitted becomes part of the database. Mm-hmm. So there were two kids in the LA area that were in different school districts, and the parents or the teacher checked and found that the kid had copied a paper from another school district. Well, anyway, that's Turnitin.com. Well, the teacher checked the papers and found that 80% of the class had plagiarized. And so she gave that 80% failing grades. And so, of course, the parents came in and said, you know, this is going to be such an amazing learning experience for my child. I'm lying. They organized and demanded that the teacher be fired. And the teacher was fired, later reinstated, but then she resigned. You know, and the question I think parents need to ask themselves is, what am I teaching my child when I make this decision? Yeah.
You know, it's something that you have to almost start so early, because when they're small, the mistakes and the things are small, and it's so much easier to deal with those consequences than later.
I think you're absolutely right. It's so much harder to stop in teenage years, start in teenage years. But my own feeling about teenagers 13 or 14 and above is, unless something is life endangering, or they may be, you know, permanently disabled by something, children should take the natural consequence. Those kids should take the natural consequences. If they're shoplifting and they get caught, the parent shouldn't hire a high power attorney and get them off. You know, the parent should allow them to deal with whatever the consequences are. Because that may, and I've had so many parents say to me, well, you know, if they get a drunk driving, then this is gonna happen, and that's gonna happen, and that's bad for the kid. Well, you know, what's gonna happen the next time they drive drunk? Maybe they'll kill a carload of kids, you know? And so you want the child to take the consequences. Mm-hmm. You know, that it teaches them about taking responsibility. Often I would get people that were counselors in colleges, and they say that now parents are trying to bail kids out at college level. Mm-hmm. And parents are trying to fill out their applications. And there are some colleges that are saying, we will not accept any kind of work that we find is done by a parent. You need to do it yourself. I was traveling somewhere, a Midwestern state, and I heard on the news that this this state university had decided to not have 7 a.m. classes anymore because they felt kids weren't getting enough sleep. I thought to myself, you know, when I stayed up too late and I had a 7 a.m. class, I dealt with the consequences of that. And I learned that I didn't like to go to 7 a.m. classes sleepy, so I got to bed earlier. But now the institution is saying, we'll make sure that the kids get more sleep, which I think is really silly. Yeah.
But developmentally, they're learning, the teenagers need to sleep late. Yeah, and so this concept that we have to force them to get to class at 7 o'clock is punitive.
Mm-hmm. Do they need to sleep late or sleep enough?
Apparently they need to sleep late.
Well, apparently
that's what the research is starting to show.
Infants and parents. Infants and teenagers.
But that's in teens. That's right.
Well,
that's
teens. But the brain development, the adult brain development, may not stop until you're 25 or 28.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So the colleges should think about that when they're designing their classes. And I agree that children should think about that when they schedule their classes, too.
Yes, because they're an adult at that point. And
legally they're an adult. But 25 is a real cutoff.
Yeah,
in terms
and
of
we discussed that, you know, about the prefrontal cortex not being fully developed till 25. But that's the learning experience have to be there. And the quality of the learning experience at college age should be learning to take the consequences of your actions.
Oh yeah. But colleges should learn to take the consequences of their actions too. And when they schedule courses where the students will not be prepared to learn, then they're setting the students up for failure.
But how many jobs are there that are at, and the 20-year-olds that are start at 2 in the morning or, you know?
Those jobs are for uneducated people. Oh. They are. Well, I'm sorry about nursing. I take it back. Shift work, 7-3-11. If you want to go to college and not do shift work, want to start at 9, then learn. But 7 o'clock is a crummy time for an intelligent person to start work.
You're kind of getting on the edges of some pretty controversial.
Absolutely.
Things. As someone with my master's degrees having done shift work, and another friend, you're going to have some unhappy campers about that statement.
That's good. We don't learn by all agreeing.
Yes, that's right.
Most college kids do better that work at the same time too, you know, that are working and contributing towards their education. Mm-hmm. Yes. And therefore would have to have a varying schedule in order to meet their job requirements and their class requirements. Yeah. And sleep deprivation is part of it, especially when you're out till 4 in the morning drinking, which a lot of them are.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. And I'm not talking about kids that, you know, need 9 hours of sleep. You know, more often it is because kids were up till 1 a.m.
Right.
And partying, and then they go to the 7 a.m. class to destroy it. Yeah.
I'm just wondering, is it more of a recent phenomenon that parents are protecting their children from? Is that more of something that's happening now than it ever has?
It is.
And I'm just wondering why.
Because I think more and more parents are thinking, you know, just some of the things that we've been talked about, that parents are taking. Feeling they need to protect their child, you know, that their child should not be unhappiness. And I'm going to move on now because we're getting to the end of our time. But kids, parents that want to prevent their kids from being unhappy, well, I think that's the biggest issue.
I just want to throw in the concept of das Überkind, you know, the child who is supposed to be absolutely wonderful at everything, and if the kid fails at something, it's a reflection on the parent. I think the parents are taking it personally in ways that previous generations didn't.
Yeah, that vicarious parenting thing that because my kid went to Harvard, you know, that means I'm a good person. Yeah.
And this is an outcome of having fewer children because you put more emotional and capital into the children because there are fewer of them. When you had 7 kids, you know, so if one was a black sheep. If you have 2 kids and you have a black sheep, it looks pretty bad.
We have a close friend who crammed 6 years of, you know, 4 years of college into 6 years.
Seven. I did 7.
Part of the reason was he would stay up all night and study for tests and be unable to get up in the morning to take the test. This is true. And that's how that happened. He today is a psychologist teaching at San Diego State, became very successful, but you know, during that traumatic time, there's lots of people that would like to have saved him, you know, getting a better alarm clock or do all kinds of things. But
and to go to our brain stuff, back to our brain stuff, you know, what they're finding about long-term memory is for long-term memory to shift into permanent memory, you need to sleep on it. And so I was one of those people that would stay up all night. And what I wasn't doing is solidifying my memories by sleeping. Okay. We'll just go through the rest. You know, parents that will say, now don't do that. Honey, you come sit down. Now don't run around. Now come here. If you don't come here, I'm going to give you a swat. You know, where they never follow through on their threats. You know, I think that what what the child begins to learn is you wait until the parent is out of control until you respond to what they have to say. And so if you're going to give a child an instruction and consequences, it needs to happen.
Yeah.
It needs to follow through. You know, some parents will say, go to your room. The room has a television, a DVD player. It has all these wonderful things, so much that I'd like to spend time in their room. You know, that's what I call sting-free discipline. It doesn't mean anything. As we talked about yesterday, negative consequences need to sting a little in order for them to have any power and to make it into the kid's memory. You know, so many parents say, well, you know, I let my kids go to parties where there's drinking because I trust them. You know, and you know, I just shake my head. Because, well, first of all, you can build trust with kids, but it doesn't happen automatically. You know, it's like if I chatted with one of you, and I thought, oh, that's a nice person, I'd like to get to know them. Does that mean I would give them the keys to my house or loan them my car? Probably not, because we haven't built up trust. And I think that that's the way it should happen with kids. You know, if a parents are going away for the weekend and the 13-year-old says, I don't want to go to Aunt Susie's for the weekend, I'll be fine at home, don't you trust me? You know, the correct answer is no. As a matter of fact, I don't trust you with that level of responsibility. Mm-hmm. Now, we can work up towards that. You know, I can start leaving you at home alone for short periods of time and see if you follow through with your homework or, you know, you take care of the house. And and maybe gradually we'll get to the point where I think, yeah, I can trust you. But it doesn't happen automatically. And just we don't have time to get into this, but I think in general, kids do better with truth. Now, truth at a level that they can understand. But, you know, I've heard so many stories from kids that have grown up and were adopted, and the parents never told them, that later find out and are really furious about it. Mm-hmm. You know, giving the kids the truth is just really an important thing to do.
Not lying to children is really
not lying. That's a better way of putting it. It's not lying to them.
Yes.
You know, and the other thing about truth is you gauge how much you tell a child by their level of interest. You know, and you also keep in mind that some questions may be manipulative rather than clear answers. Questions of truth. Didn't you smoke marijuana, Dad? You know, we're having a discussion about you right now. Mm-hmm. And what possible difference will it make to discuss my behavior? You know, I think in a case where it's a manipulative, let's get off the subject and talk about you for a while. Mm-hmm. I think it's okay to not give information. And remember we talked about Clark Dawson and Bretta Hoft. They say structure is the bones of child rearing. Nurture cushions the bones. You need the bones. The bones are absolutely essential. And I compare it to some parents that structure is like a sport. You know, what is a sport if you take all the rules away? Nothing. Just a lot of mayhem. It's rules that give structure and meaning to the activity. And so what the family needs rules in order to give structure. Now, they don't have to be detailed rules. I mean, they can be general rules. And some can be guidelines. But you need the structure. You know, it's not okay to be mean to other kids. You know, that's a general structure statement. And, you know, the term discipline has gotten kind of a bad reputation as something that nasty people do or strict parents do. And actually, if you look at the word term discipline, it comes from a Latin word, disciplina, which means to educate or to teach. The best kind of discipline is when you teach a child something. You know, so for example, if you come home and your child has fixed himself a snack of a peanut butter and jelly sandwich and left the jelly jar open and the sticky knife and pieces of peanut butter and jelly on the counter, you can say, that's a timeout. Now, what will that teach? It'll teach something, but not that much. What might be better is, you know, you've made a big mess, and that's something that's icky to clean up. So I think you need experience in cleaning up these kinds of messes. So for the next 2 days, you need to clean up everybody else's mess in the kitchen. You know, that might be overboard, but, you know, or for the next period of time. But what it is doing is giving the child experience. You know, I worked in a residential treatment center where there was, and you couldn't do it nowadays because there's laws against it, but I liked it. You know, if a child was not behaving in school and refusing to do the work, the medical director would say to the child, well, apparently you don't want a career that requires an education, so I'm going to train you to be a janitor. And so I'm going to have you washing walls for a while and mopping the floor. And, you know, I thought that was great. I thought that was terrific, but of course you can't do that now.
We had one daughter who said every job she had, you know, and she started out bagging groceries, she learned what she didn't want to do for the rest of her life.
And I think that's true. You know, that those kind of early experiences at work can be very formative. And Holden has lots of them.
Yes.
You know, garbology is a wonderful experience for a kid. Mm-hmm. Dish team. Being, you know, and I like to differentiate between punishment and discipline, because punishment is about retribution. Punishment is about anger. And sometimes parents will say, what do you think about spanking? And what I'll say is, well, spanking can be okay in some circumstances as long as the parent isn't angry when they do it.
How often does that happen?
Yeah. And who wants to spank their kid when they're not angry? You know, you just don't want to. And so that tells you a lot about the fact that spanking is punishment rather than discipline. You know, when a parking meter person gives out a ticket, they don't yell at you and say, shame, 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 you're an awful person. They just put the ticket on your car. And that's kind of what discipline is. I think it's great to say to kids, I'm really sorry you made that choice. And as you recall, this is the consequence. I like the word choice because it's helping the kid realize that they need to take responsibility for their actions. And just some qualities of a consequence. First of all, I think it's best when it's given without anger. And one rule that I think is good to remember is you don't have to give a consequence right at the minute it happens. There's no time limit. Yeah.
Well, what about really young children, like toddler, preschool age? Is the consequence important to give it right?
Well, yeah. When kids are pre-verbal, I think it needs to be close to the situation. But, you know, as kids get more cognitively ready, I think then the parent can say, and it's also good modeling. you know, I'm feeling really irritated right now, and I think I need a little time out. And in the meantime, I want you to go to your bedroom and think about this. And then when I'm calmed down, I'll tell you what the consequence is going to be. And that's done three things. First, it's modeled good anger management. Second, they're going to be worried for a while, which is a good thing. And third, you've given yourself the time to think it through.
Can you do that with a toddler, too? I mean, I've done that. To where I had to take a break from a situation, but I did not for a while, but just for a minute, and then
Then it has to be a little bit closer. It may be taking some deep breaths, and the best consequences are ones that represent cause and effect. Mm-hmm. Now there was this one teenager who had kind of her old junker car, and in a cold climate, and she used to leave it out when it was snowing. And when the snow plows would come through, her car would be towed because she left it out. And this was a lot of hassle for the parents because they had to go with her, you know, and they thought, you know, we want her to experience the consequences, but we don't want to have to experience the consequences. Mm-hmm. So what they did is they simulated it. If she left her car out when it started snowing and she wasn't looking like she was moving it off the street, they'd put it in the garage and padlock the garage. And then she would have to pay the fine that she needed to pay to get her car out of, you know, hock. And so they didn't have to experience the consequences, but she did. So it represented cause and effect. That was very clever.
If you have a garage, that works.
And then I just want to mention that positives need to outweigh negatives. You know, if you have, and this happens a lot when teenagers are out of control, the parent will be all focused on what consequences should I give them for their bad behavior, and that's all they want to focus on. Well, you're not going to get change unless you have at least 51% positive, because what you stroke is what you get. What you pay the most attention to is what you're going to get. So then it's really important for the parent to begin paying attention. Now, I don't mean a lot of external rewards. I think if parents have done a good job of connecting with their kids, really having a relationship with their children, then a smile or a compliment or even just a simple statement of fact can be reinforcing. Mm-hmm. The dishes are really clean. How do you feel about the job you did? Mm-hmm. Yeah, it feels good to do a good job, doesn't it? Let the kids self-evaluate. But you know, you need that strong, positive relationship. And just a couple more quick comments, and then we have to stop.
I just want to say, in our pediatrician's office, there's a poster that says, for every criticism you offer your child, there should be 9 or 10 praises.
Yeah. It's a principle with playing the piano. Mm-hmm. You know, if you make a mistake, you need to go back and practice it. I don't remember the number of times I was told, but you need to have the good experience a lot more times than you need to have the negative experience. And part of it is just noticing. You know, a lot of times we'll see our kids doing something great, but we may not say anything. It's so easy to say, good job, or you got your homework done.
Yeah. I know we're about to stop, but I wonder if you could just say something about over-focusing on self-reward, on self-esteem. Steve. Because I think
that's
that's just, and that's especially hard for grandparents.
Okay. You're always telling them how wonderful they are. And that's what you feel they are.
Well, all grandchildren are precocious.
Grandparents have certain, you know, privileges, but, you know, I just wanted to bring up something that happened in the village the other day, and I don't know if the parents are present, so if this is your child, but I was noticing this one kid who can knit really well, and he was teaching an adult to knit. Mm-hmm. And what?
It's my son.
It was your son? Mm-hmm. What a treat that was to watch that. He felt so competent.
He is.
Mm-hmm. And I watched him teaching, and he was doing a really excellent job. In fact, he was doing reinforcement. He was saying what a good job she was doing. Here this physician is learning how to knit, and he's very nicely telling her, that was a good job on that row. You
know? You have to add, he's only seven.
Yeah.
It's amazing. And the thing was that I think self-esteem comes from competence. You know, that feeling like I can do something. I'm not saying that reward doesn't have its place, but I think the real strong feelings of self-esteem comes from feelings of competence. And so, you know, helping kids to be competent is the best way. And, you know, it's kind of like are you gonna put a big fence around your pool, or are you gonna teach your kids to swim? You know, that teaching the kids to swim is a much better precaution than building a high fence. I'm not saying you shouldn't build a fence, you know, but and I always am so grateful when my son tells me something I did right, you know, and so he's 31 and he was visiting and we were out for lunch, and I was telling him about this workshop I was doing at that time, and I was talking about this very issue, and he said, well, remember what you did when I was in either fourth or fifth grade? And I said, no. And he said, well, I had this report that I had to do, and I was really upset because it had a lot of parts, and I didn't see how I could get it all done. And so you took the calendar down and said, let's break it into pieces. I want you to figure out how much you can do in an hour. And we will put those pieces on days. And then you'll have the project finished a day before it's due. And we put it down. And he got out his calendar, and I have no recollection of this, but he got out his calendar, and he was getting ready to move, and he had his task all written down on his calendar. And I, you know, I was so grateful that he remembered one good thing I'd done. But I think that idea to plan is giving them tools that help their competency and therefore their self-esteem. I'm sorry we didn't get through all the points, but I think we got through many of the important ones. And I want to thank you all for your patience and your participation. And
thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you.